Support for Studio 360's podcast comes from the car company Scion. As part of its Motivate program, Scion invited 50 semifinalists to LA, where they were provided mentors, attended seminars, and met with advisors. Then, the 10 that most improved received $10,000, a Scion, and continued access to mentors. You can track their success at scion.com.
And the Tony Award goes to...
On Sunday, Broadway does its annual national celebration of itself, the Tony Awards. And the show that's nominated in every possible category but one is about a strange little girl with horrible parents, Matilda.
Sometimes you have to be a little bit naughty.
I'll talk with comedian and musician Tim Minchin, the show's composer, who will play and sing a few of Matilda's songs for us.
If you always take it on the chin and wearing, nothing will change.
Plus, we'll launch our latest listener challenge. It's the battle of America's high school bands, past and present. Ready, set, upload. I'm Kurt Anderson. That and more is ahead this hour in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC, right after this.
Support for Studio 360 comes from the car company Scion, dedicated to supporting new talent. At the Scion Motivate Conference, 10 young entrepreneurs were awarded a car, capital, and mentoring. One awardee was Notes for Notes, a nonprofit program in Nashville providing music education to kids. Learn more at scion.com.
High School USA.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson.
Well, I want to do the high school bopping with you, yeah!
Today we're kicking off a new challenge to our listeners. We're looking for the best high school rock band in America, ever. We brought in a couple of actual rock stars to judge the contest and talk about their own high school band experiences, the good, the bad, and the creepy.
Harm, do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do, is what you're in for if you don't open that door.
I mean, okay, as a parent, I call the cops.
Yeah, I guess you're right.
Andrew W.K. and Tao Nguyen later in the hour, but first...
Hi, everybody. What a great way to start the show. Welcome, everyone, to the 66th...
This Sunday, Neil Patrick Harris hosts the 67th Tony Awards. When he hosted last year, his big opening number asked, what if life were more like theater?
And what if all your questions had rhyming answers and you never left home without your backup dancers? What if life were more like theater? Wouldn't life be grand?
Maybe real life, like musical theater, would be grand, although as a non-singing, non-dance man, I would suck at it. But walking that knife edge between make-believe and reality absolutely is what makes amazing theater amazing. Take Tracy Letts' Tony-nominated performance as George in this season's terrific revival of Edward Albee's Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. George and Martha's marriage looks like a co-enabled nightmare.
Yes, Martha, can I get you something?
Well, sure. You can light my cigarette if you're of a mind to.
No. There are limits. I mean, man can put up with only so much without he descends a rung or two on the old evolutionary ladder, which is up your line. Sinks, Martha, and it's a funny ladder. You can't reverse yourself, start back up once you're descending. Now I'll... hold your hand when it's dark and you're afraid of the boogeyman, and I'll tote your gin bottles out after midnight so no one will see. But I will not light your cigarette. And that, as they say, is that.
But Tracy Letts, best known as a Tony-winning playwright for August Osage County, told me he sees something different in their venomous relationship.
Well, I think it's in some ways the secret of the success of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, the fact that they're in love. I think if they were just at war, then they're just a cartoon. Then they're just the Bickersons or something. There's more at stake than that. To tell you the truth, the more I do it, the more I think a lot of married people in our audience would love to be in a relationship like George and Martha.
No.
Yeah, absolutely.
Really?
Put down the remote control and get up and fight with me. You know, get yourself out of your stupor and see if you're willing to get up and get down to it.
At least
me.
They're alive?
Yeah. They're alive and they're engaged with each other.
Yeah.
I guess what I hope is that they don't simply get up and leave the theater and go, that's not me. I would hope that they see something that applies to them in their lives.
This season, the actress Fiona Shaw also brought a bracing sense of realism to a character who usually exists as this pure paragon of virtue. In the Tony-nominated Testament of Mary, she played Mary, the mother of Jesus. Shaw wanted her depiction of Mary to feel like a real grieving mother. She's bewildered and bitter.
My son gathered misfits, although he himself, despite everything, was not a misfit. He could have done anything. He could have even been quiet. He had that quality, too. He was graceful, good-mannered. He was intelligent, and he used all of it, I said, to lead a group of misfits from place to place. Gather together misfits, I said, and you will get recklessness, you'll get ambition, you'll get anything at all, and it will lead to what I saw, which is the worst sort of catastrophe. And I watched him pushing a plate of half-eaten food towards me like a child in a tantrum.
I asked her if, growing up Roman Catholic in Ireland, she'd known Mary only as a saintly blank.
Saintly blank is very good. Actually, that's exactly what she was being proffered as. She wore pale blue. She was in statues. She had no personality. She never said anything in the New Testament to make any of the Gospels interesting on a Sunday. She sort of hung around on the side, passive, watery, milky, actually, kind of milky.
And sort of invites a filling in by a presumptuous playwright.
Yes, it does. And I think the really good thing is that, you know, why should she not have been a mother of a family or married to a husband who she loved as much as anyone else? But the church was so busy, the early church, trying to neutralize the power of the female, I think.
Right. So she had to be this two-dimensional sort of figure. And Tom Hanks is Tony-nominated for his Broadway debut, playing a very real guy, warts and all. The role was the late New York tabloid reporter Mike McAlary in Lucky Guy, a play by the late Nora Ephron.
I am a newspaper reporter. And I love my job. And I'm doing God's work. I'm serving the public. I'm telling people what happened yesterday. I'm telling them the facts.
It had to be a stretch for Hanks, the ultimate good guy mensch, whereas McAlary...
Well, he was. He was just kind of a jerk. Can you say on public radio?
I think you can say.
Oh, there you go. I love this. I love this. You know, there's perks and burdens, and that's one of the perks, I guess. And I did not know him. I had not read him. But years later, la la la, da da da, let's throw the calendar pages, the front
pages. Cue that music, too.
The time passing montage music. And a couple of years ago, I saw Nora all the time, and we, you know, talked always about what we were up to. And she said, well, I did another version of the play about that guy you said was an asshole. I said, oh, well, let me read it again. And from that came our production at the Broadhurst.
Would you have done it if this particular play, if your friend and multiple collaborator Nora Ephron hadn't written it?
Well, she was definitely a great attraction because Nora was a good hang. She was a fun person to spend as much time with as possible. You always ate well. You always laughed. You were always constantly talking about the pulse of the nation and the world at the time. Yes, I think the play was fascinating enough. Wanting to come and do a Broadway show is, I think, in the DNA of every actor that's out there, particularly one that used to live on 45th Street, right around the corner from where the theater is. So, and not knowing the story of Mike McAlary, this was brand new turf for me.
Lucky Guy got a lot of attention because it was the last work by the widely adored Nora Ephron, who died last summer. Ephron worked closely with the play's director, George Wolfe. I spoke with Wolf about that at an event last month.
Nora had an incredible series of skill sets. I mean, I would talk to her about, I'd say, this needs to go and this needs to go, and she would say brilliantly, I'm sure you're 100% right, George, but I am not prepared to say goodbye to that. And then we move on to the next thing. I mean, her skills of deflecting were just incredibly brilliant. And but at the same time, What was really fascinating is I would give her tons and tons and tons of notes, and she would take them, and I would say, take your time. And then she'd be back a week later or a week and a half later with a new draft. And I was at the time, I was sort of dazzled, and I was sort of frustrated. Breathe with it. But as it turns out, she was working at a very different timetable.
Because she had been, she was sick.
She was sick, and it was, and I didn't know this, and a finite number of people knew it. But there was just the ferocity and the discipline and the rigor that she approached the work was just astonishing. In some strange way, I felt like the time that we spent and the rigor of the time that we spent was in preparation
for having to do it
for having to do it without her. I mean, it's the and the parallels that it was fascinating dynamic that she read McAlary's obituary and went, "This will be a great play." McAlary was on his way to interview Abner Louima, which was his crowning case when he was on chemo. Nora started, or by the time that she started work with me, started chemo.
Which on this play. And so this other authorial subtext was entirely invisible to you.
It completely.
And to Tom Banks. And
to everybody, but it was being played out. And it was very interesting. On opening night, there were all these projections, and then opening night, as part of the curtain call, we on the projections, we added Nora's picture. And when we did in rehearsal, it was, we turn around, we point, everything was fine. And then in the moment of opening night and the cumulative dynamic of working on the play, because we went into rehearsal January 14th, all of a sudden this technical thing became instantly rawly emotional.
That is director George Wolfe talking about his collaboration with the late Nora Ephron. You can hear my whole conversation with Wolfe at studio360.org, as well as my full interviews with Tom Hanks, Fiona Shaw, and Tracy Letts. Still ahead this hour in Studio 360, Tim Minchin will perform some songs for us from Matilda, his terrific musical nominated for a dozen Tonys. And I'll sing along.
And even if you put in heaps of effort, you're just wasting.
That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
I have suffered in this jail, have been trapped inside this cage.
Support for Studio 360 comes from the car company Scion, dedicated to supporting new talent. At the Scion Motivate Conference, 10 young entrepreneurs were awarded a car, capital, and mentoring. One awardee was Lilco, a letterpress and design studio in Dallas. Learn more at scion.com.
I'm just a stupid keyboard player in a high school band.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. One of my favorite things to do on this show is invite you all to make things. Whether it's a remix of bird songs or a photo montage, it gives us the chance to see just how creative our listeners can be. So, get ready. We're launching a new challenge.
I used to have Rock Band back in high school.
I don't even know what it is, but you got it.
I don't love the high school band.
Excellent!
It's the Battle of the High School Bands. We want to hear the music you and your friends made in high school, whether that was a couple of months ago or 50 years past. Judging the contest for us are two actual rock stars who got their starts in high school. Andrew W.K., self-described party rocker. And Tao Nguyen of Tao and the Get Down Stay Down. Andrew, Tao, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Andrew, turn off your phone.
Okay.
So, you are both successful musicians now, but I want to go back to and relive your high school days. Andrew, do you have any memories of the music you were writing back in Michigan?
No, I don't have any memories since yesterday, but I have been told that I did a lot of musical work, and also some friends of mine remember those years, and I played bass in a few bands and drums. Definitely cut my eye teeth.
What was the best band name of a band you were in?
It was a band called Lab Lobotomy, and initially we had misspelled, or I will take credit, I misspelled the name as Lobotomy, spelled L-A-B. lobotomy when it's in fact L-O-B. So then we made up for that by making it lab lobotomy, best of both worlds or worst of both worlds.
And Tao, as we found out in the story we did about you several years ago, you spent a lot of time playing music, among other places, at your mom's laundromat in suburban D.C. during high school. What was the rest of your music career as a high school kid like?
The rest of my music career, I remember one summer we had a band wherein we tried to cover Eric Clapton's Cocaine, but I wasn't that good of a guitar player at that point, so there were a lot of things that failed me, and we just did the chorus over and over again. Cocaine, something like that.
Mm.
Did either of you have this sort of aha moment in high school where you said, music, this is it, this is how I'm going to spend my life?
I imagined myself being interviewed by Oprah Winfrey and what would be the most direct / feasible route.
Wow, you really haven't gotten there because it's just me you're being interviewed by.
This is leagues,
really?
Leagues beyond okay. any sort of show on, what's her network called now?
Own,
yeah. I would much rather do this than own, so thank you, Kurt.
Well, I had started with piano lessons, again, according to my parents, around age 4 and a half, and it wasn't until I moved to New York after high school that I decided to become a professional partier.
So I am guessing that some of our listeners who are or especially were in bands might be nervous about sharing their high school music with us and you, but maybe we encourage them by each of you talking about a couple of your toughest moments in the high school music business, such as it is.
I have a great story, and actually one of my first recording experiences where I really tried very hard to make a very good sounding song with multi-track overdubs and whatnot, and it was a tribute, a song written for this beautiful young lady that I had a crush on, whose name was Liza, and I made it on cassette and gave it to her, and it turned into a big disaster. Long story short, a juvenile restraining order was put on me for the remainder of my high school.
I didn't know there were juvenile restraining orders.
Well, they came up with one for me. I mean, I think it was one of the most embarrassing things I ever did because eventually, of course, the whole school had made copies of this cassette.
Do you remember any of that song?
Oh, absolutely. I remember the whole thing, unfortunately.
You want to sing just a bit?
Okay. Drove past your doorway 13 times. I don't mean to cause you harm. And then real quickly here. Harm do 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 is what you're in for if you don't open that door.
I mean, okay, as a parent, I call the cops.
Yeah, I guess you're right.
And Tao, did you or any memorable moments?
Harm is what you're in for? That's amazing. A vivid moment of defeat was my sophomore year of high school. We had a talent show. It was a three-piece band, and it was two songs about David Knoll, who I loved. And we placed second, and the first place was a vibraphone duet of Tom Petty's Free Falling, which actually was incredible. So,
And who was the amazing David Knoll?
He's just this guy I had a crush on.
Ah,
see, it all ties together.
Yeah.
It's a very natural inclination, I think, to sing to someone that you want. It's true.
Yeah.
And Tao, what makes a great high school band?
Enthusiasm and lack of attention to detail.
Really? There's a certain sloppiness involved in being in a high school band?
I think there's a looseness that can't ever be replicated, and that's the energy. That's the freewheeling energy that makes anything worthwhile.
Since we want listeners who are or were in bands to convert their old tapes and maybe even vinyl, for all we know, to MP3 in order to share it with the world, any final words of encouragement to the thousands of people out there who are suddenly saying, yeah, my band was great in 1984?
I hope that it does feel that way for anyone who was ever in a band. I hope it is an experience, if not to continue, but at least to look back on fondly. And I really would love to hear that music, and I bet what could be most exciting is that when you listen back, I bet it's going to be even better than you even remembered it being and even better than you thought it would be. And hopefully good enough to win.
So, current and recent high schoolers and former adolescent rockers, send us the best piece of music you made between freshman and senior year. We'll play some of our favorites on the show, and Tao and Andrew will come back to pick the winners and record a cover of the winning song.
We can't wait. Thank you.
Thank you.
All the details are at studio360.org/myhighschoolband. The deadline is July 7th. You can hear the full version of Andrew WK's Teenage Stalker Ballad at studio360.org. And here's a song from Tao Nguyen's high school band, Other Girls.
Those other girls that make you tall, they are everything besides what I'm not. And I am not just another other girl. You don't know me.
Thank you for that. I'm sorry about the phone thing.
Oh, don't worry.
Got money, I'll do anything for you. A defining artifact of our time is the mashup. There are mashup YouTube videos, mashup songs, mashup literature. Wherever there's a will to combine disparate bits of entertainment or art, a mashup gets made. And when it's done right, the result can be fresh and illuminating. I recently met up with a painter whose work comes out of that mashup sensibility. Iona Rozeal Brown creates vibrant pictures that mix traditional Japanese visual art motifs with hip-hop imagery.
Hi, Kurt.
You must be Iona.
I am.
Good to meet you.
Likewise.
Really happy to be here.
We got together at her show at the Edward Tyler Nahum Gallery in New York to look at and talk about some of her new work.
The show is called No One's Ever Gonna Love You, So Don't Wonder.
Right.
What does that mean?
Well, there's a song by Maxwell, which is a mashup of a title of his song, which is Don't Ever Wonder. And then the sample that they use for the remix is from a song that the SOS band did called No One's Gonna Love You. But the rest of that is No One's Gonna Love You Better Than I. But it's still a very, like, controlling kind of thing. And
it's a mashup, as you say, which you are all about.
I am.
Brown's paintings are a play on the ancient erotic Japanese art called shunga, which usually depicts courtesans and their patrons having sex. Her images are surprisingly less racy than traditional Japanese shunga from centuries ago. In one, a man and a woman with blue and brown skin are embracing, their lips almost touching. Their hair is Afro-like. Their faces have both African and Asian features, and surrounding them is a thick mass of white fur.
Yeah, well, that's her fur.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, she's got her beginnings of a snake tattoo here, the chrysanthemum flower. She takes up most of the, almost the entire picture frame. His hand is holding.
He's really secondary. Exactly. It's really a picture of her.
Brown's African-American and grew up in Washington, D.C. I asked how she got interested in Japanese culture.
When I was about 7 or 9, my mother took me to see the Bunraku at the Kennedy Center. I already loved puppets. I mean, I grew up watching Sesame Street, and I remembered being really focused on the dolls and the movement. Then when I get to be probably 11 or 13, I went to see the Kabuki. And I think also seeing Speed Racer and Kimba and all these beginning animes.
Japanese animation.
Exactly. Yeah. It just stayed with me, and I never really presumed that it wasn't supposed to be in my life.
Eventually, she made her way to Japan, where she was fascinated and troubled by an interesting subcultural phenomenon. Japanese kids, especially teenage girls, who darken their skin. It's called gangro, which translates as blackface.
Gangro actually is supposed to be gang, like gang of girls, or brown-faced girl, I believe is what it's called, and they travel in packs, so it's multi-meanings with this word, gangro. And they were really interested in challenging Japan's ideals of beauty, which I thought it was interesting that they picked to go brown as opposed to, like, purple or something. So it's a spectacle.
It's like they're creating a tableau vivant. It's like some artwork they're
exactly
participating in.
It's beautiful. I mean, they've got white around their eyes and around their lips, which immediately made me think of Al Jolson, but, you know.
In a bad way?
Well, I don't know how many good thoughts I've ever had about Al Jolson.
Yeah.
All of Brown's obsessions converge in the huge diptych she calls The Reunion. Its couple are intertwined on top of a black fur rug. Behind them is a wall of stereo speakers. Brown skin covers their blue skin like masks. And the woman has an impressive pile of blue braids balanced on her head.
That's the largest hair I've ever seen, I think.
Awesome. This particular hairstyle was inspired not only by the extensions and braids that we as African-American women will sometimes don, but the Mao women of China and these huge hairstyles and these cloths that were wrapped around them. I got very inspired. So her hair is wrapped with this off-white cloth, and then I wrapped his hair, his little dreadlock, about three dreadlocks that I've got wrapped up. And these are a kind of a play on a shoes that I got in Japan with the toe, they're like the tabi shoes.
They're also sneakers.
They are. Yeah. And this actually, I was giving a nod to Spike Lee. I didn't know much about Brooklyn before Spike Lee did She's Gotta Have It. But in that movie, his character, Mars Blackman, ends up having sex with Nola Darling and he keeps his sneakers on.
What about Nola Darling? What do you want to know? I thought she was a freak. You know, freaky dicky. Sex was death. Nola had the goods and she knew what to do.
I thought that was hilarious then, and I still think it's funny now.
What Brown's doing as a visual artist is sort of like what DJs do when they mix samples of Punjabi Bhangra with Parliament Funkadelic. As it turns out, Brown plays with turntables, too. And you've always been a DJ, or since you were, what, a teenager?
Yes, I didn't actually buy decks until much later, but when I would go to parties, I was always the one with the records. Maybe because of the fact that I'm a DJ, I felt like I could just freely sample. But my intention has always been one of respect and not maliciousness and not to say, oh, well, I made that up. No, I got that exactly from here.
Iona, thank you.
Thank you, Kurt, so much. It's my pleasure.
Iona Rozeal Brown's paintings are now on exhibit in her hometown of Washington. You can find out where and see images at studio360.org.
And now, Deep Thoughts by Jack Handy.
If you're a longtime listener to the show, you may remember hearing Jack Handy from time to time. He's the creator of Saturday Night Live's Deep Thoughts. And now, like John Updike and Snooki before him, he's publishing his first novel. To honor this transition, we thought we'd present one of Jack Handy's classic works of short fiction read by him.
Little Tiny Stories by Jack Handy. Slim Pickings. I had never eaten dog before, and I didn't intend to start now. Just give me a little more of the co-pilot, I said, extending my plate. Blow dart. The first blow dart hit me in the neck. The second hit me in the leg. After that, I blacked out. When I woke up, I asked Lalani how many blow darts had hit me. She seemed annoyed. What am I, she said. Your personal blow dart counter? Invisible guy. If it worked correctly, the paste I was smearing on my body would make me invisible. And even if it didn't, it would probably moisturize my skin. Lost world. A world ruled by dinosaurs? It didn't make any sense. I could understand a world where dinosaurs had some say, but not rule. Drugged. After I finished my second double gin and tonic, I felt woozy, unstable on my feet. Then I realized my drink had probably been drugged. I had a beer, then two more to clean out my system, but they made me feel even dizzier. I thought some exercise might counteract the drug, so I got up on the diving board and started dancing. But it was no use. When the drug finally wore off, I was lying in the backyard wearing nothing but a hula skirt. A harsh lesson. I tried to explain to little Betsy how, when horses get old, you have to take them out and shoot them. But then I thought, Why not wait until she gets a horse? The severed head. You don't forget the first time you ever see a severed head, especially if it's your best friend Don, and especially if he's got a cigar clenched between his teeth, even though the last time you saw your so-called friend, he swore he didn't have any more cigars. Adrift. I drifted in the lifeboat for days, maybe months. To be honest, I guess it wasn't months. That would be too long. Weeks is probably too long, too, because I would have dried out or something by then. Hours is too short. To tell you the truth, I don't even think it was a lifeboat. Big shoes and bullets. I knew if I was ever going to catch the killer clown, it wasn't going to be enough to dress up like a clown. I also had to think like a clown. The look on her face. Hold on to my hand, I yelled. I can't, said Lucinda. I'm slipping. Hold on, I screamed. But it was too late. She let go and fell, landing hard on her buttocks. And that was the last time we ever went square dancing. The sad farewell. I tried to explain to Lalani that she could not come back with me to civilization, that she would die there. A tear trickled down her cheek. Then she put something in my hand. It was a shrunken head, the same one that had made us laugh so much that first day. Pray tell me. As I understood it, the tribe would give me a head start, and then they would hunt me down for sport. I got an idea. Instead of running, I began to ask them a bunch of questions about the rules, to stall and confuse them. That's when the clubbing began.
That's Jack Handy reading from Little Tiny Stories, with sound design by Jill Duboff. Handy's novel, The Stench of Honolulu, comes out next month, and we will be featuring excerpts from it over the next few weeks. In a minute, we'll all sing along with Tim Minchin, the man behind the hit musical Matilda. He'll perform live next, right here in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Support for Studio 360 comes from the car company Scion, dedicated to supporting new talent. At the Scion Motivate Conference, 10 young entrepreneurs were awarded a car, capital, and mentoring. One awardee was Wonderheads, a Portland theater company specializing in mask performances. Learn more at scion.com.
This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson.
Thank you, God, for fixing the cataracts of Sam's mom.
Singer-songwriter Tim Minchin is best known for his smart, edgy songs that have fun with subjects like God and destiny.
You only need to pray in a particular spot to a particular version of a particular God. And if you pull that off without a hitch, he will fix one eye of one middle-class white.
And now he's taken on a different kind of serious subject, childhood.
And when I grow up, I will eat sweets every day. On the way to work and I will go to bed late every night.
Minchin wrote the score for Matilda, the new musical that's now on Broadway. It's based on Roald Dahl's novel about this extraordinary girl trying to escape her dismal life. Tim Minchin is here with me now, sitting behind our Studio 360 grand piano. Tim Minchin, welcome.
Thank you, Kurt. Thank you for having me again.
So Matilda is nominated for 12 Tonys. In fact, 12 of the 14 categories in which it was possible to be nominated. Did you grow up reading Roald Dahl?
Yeah. Like, without a doubt, the predominant author of my childhood.
Really? Do you remember your first encounter with Matilda?
Well, Matilda came late. So Matilda was written in 88, by which stage I was in my early teens. And
But you read it.
But I read it, yeah.
Well, then shortly after, you had this idea at age some young age, 23, to like, let's turn this into a show.
Yeah, I was writing music for children's theatre. In my 20s, I wrote a lot of music for theatre, mostly youth theatre and amateur stuff in Perth, yeah, in my hometown. And I had been writing for a children's theatre company, and I just, at some point, I don't really remember the context of it, but at some point I thought, God, that's got to be a musical. Certainly when I went into a meeting with the director, Matthew Warchus, 10 years later, and he said, have you heard of Matilda? It felt like what fate would feel like if you believed in fate.
Yeah. Dahl is, among other things, one of the only children's book writers who kind of revels in kids being bad in the way kids sometimes are, people sometimes are. And Matilda makes the case for the necessity of sometimes breaking the rules, being bad, being naughty. Now that you have little children, do you still fully believe that idea?
I think my six-year-old has a problem with this because Matilda says sometimes you have to be naughty. And my daughter says, why is it okay to be naughty? Because naughty really means bad to Violet, my six-year-old. Whereas I guess, you know, as you get a more sophisticated idea of naughty, it sort of means a bit cheeky or rebellious or whatever. But I have to explain to her that Matilda has no options but revenge early in the play. She has to do these little tricks and things to, because her parents are utterly awful.
And whereas Violet, you have this wonderful daddy and mommy.
You have perfect daddy. and she sort of understands that. But I think the thing about Dahl in most of his books, and the thing that we managed to perhaps capture, is that all the tools you need as a kid to free yourself are inherent in being a child.
Speaking of naughty, can you play it?
Sure, I'll play it for you. This is Matilda's first song.
Jack and Jill went up the hill to fetch a pail of water. So they say, the subsequent fall was inevitable. They never stood a chance, they were written that way. Innocent victims of their story. Like Romeo and Juliet, 'twas written in the stars before they even met, that love and fate and a touch of stupidity would rob them of their hope of living happily. The endings are often a little bit gory. I wonder why they didn't just change their story. We're told we have to do what we're told, but surely sometimes you have to be a little bit naughty. Just because you find that life's not fair, it doesn't mean that you just have to grin and bear it. If you always take it on the chin and wear it, nothing will change. Even if you're little, you can do a lot. You mustn't let a little thing like little stop you. If you sit around and let them get on top, you might as well be saying you think that it's okay. And that's not right. And if it's not right, you have to put it right. In the slip of a bolt, there's a tiny revolt. The seed of a war in the creak of a floorboard. A storm can begin with the flap of a wing. The tiniest mite packs the mightiest sting. Every day starts with the tick of a clock. All escapes start with the click of a lock. If you're stuck in your story and wanna get out, you don't have to cry, you don't have to shout. 'Cause if you're little, you can do a lot. You mustn't let a little thing like little stop you. If you sit around and let them get on top, you won't change a thing. Just because you find that life's not fair, it doesn't mean that you just have to grin and bear it. If you always take it on the chin and wear it, you might as well be saying you think that it's okay. And that's not right. And if it's not right, you have to put it right. And nobody else is gonna put it right for me. Nobody but me is gonna change my story. Sometimes you have to be a little bit naughty.
And that was Tim Minchin performing Naughty from his dozen Tony-nominated gigantic international boffo hit musical Matilda, now playing on Broadway.
It's a tiny little gigantic hit.
the London critics loved the show when it opened there. When you were getting ready to bring it to the United States, were there any serious worries about, will they get this? How do we translate this? What do we need to change? Did you change things?
Yeah, there's huge concerns about that because Broadway is a huge thing, and you don't enter into that arena ill prepared. And there was a lot of discussion about how we make sure American audiences got everything out of it.
Were there Britishisms? Because Matilda's parents, I mean, their awfulness is partly rooted in a certain kind of British class context that you could imagine. Ooh, are the Americans going to get this?
Well, there's various layers of this. One is, I guess, the understanding of class and stuff. But as an Australian, I actually don't get that, nor really care. I don't think there's a crassness in the way they speak, which unfortunately does seem to tip its hat towards a particular socioeconomic group or something. But I don't think that's the point. The point is just that the rhythms are brassy, and American audiences know that there's other lexicons out there. They're happy to expand to that, but what you don't want to do is have their brains going sideways to some translation mode when they need to be concentrating on what's happening next. So there are moments when a child says, someone poured a whole can of treacle on, and so we changed it to syrup. And, you know, it's the jumper sweater thing. It's just all we changed were tiny things where we thought they're going to be distracted by this. Let's make sure they're not.
When Matilda, the character, discovers her telekinetic powers, that she can make things float and fly, there's a moment when the song could have gone all Disney and cute. And
it did.
You think it did?
The first draft.
Really?
The first draft did. And it was exactly that. The brief was when she first feels this power, this amazing mind of her finally kind of almost spills out into the world, and she tips over a cup initially. It's a very modest act of telekinesis. I was sort of thinking, well, how do we do this? What does she feel about this, and where does it come from? So I wrote a piece that started with her trying to describe this bubbling and boiling and stuff, and that part of the song stayed there. But her conclusion of how she felt when it was done was a moment. The song was called Magical, and it was very, very wrong. It was one of those songs, even as I sat the director and the writers down and said, this is my draft, I knew it was wrong.
Huh.
And then went through this process. If she doesn't feel magical, does she feel huge? Imagine this tiny kid singing about feeling like a giant. Or imagine a tiny kid who has always felt too big for the space because her mind's so big, saying she finally feels small. Maybe there's a double irony there. And then I settled on the idea that it's peace that she achieves.
Can we hear that song?
Oh, yeah, all right. You ever wondered, well I have, about how when I say red, for example, there's no way of knowing if red means the same thing in your head as red means in my head when someone says red, and how if we are traveling at almost the speed of light and we're holding a light, that light would still travel away from us at the full speed of light, which seems right in a way, but I'm trying to say I'm not sure, but I wonder if inside my head I'm not just a bit different from some of my friends. These answers that come into my mind unbidden, these stories delivered to me fully written, and when everyone shouts like they seem to like shouting, the noise in my head is incredibly loud, and I just wish they'd stop. My dad and my mum and the telly and the stories would stop for just once, and I'm sorry I'm not quite explaining it right, but this noise becomes anger, and the anger is light, and the burning inside me would usually fade, but it isn't today, and the heat and the shouting, and my heart is pounding, and my eyes are burning, and suddenly everything is. Quiet. Like silence, but not really silent.
just that nice sort of quiet, like the sound of a page being turned in a book, or a pause in a walk in the woods. Quiet. Like silence, but not really silent. Just that still sort of quiet. Like the sound when you lie upside down in your bed. Just the sound of your heart in your head. And though the people around me, their mouths are still moving, the words they are for me cannot reach me anymore. And it is quiet, and I am warm. Like I've sailed into the eye of the storm.
Well done. That was Tim Minchin performing his song Quiet from the Broadway musical Matilda. One of my favorite songs in the show is called School Song, which weaves all the letters of the alphabet through the lyrics line by line in order. Now, how did you come to do that? Was that the idea of, oh, an alphabet song? And then you, like, doing the making a crossword puzzle, figured out how to do it?
Yeah, it's quite unromantic, actually, the origin of that. I stole the idea. So I had seen a cabaret show by an incredible songwriter friend of mine called Casey Bonetto in Melbourne, and he had written a love song called The ABC of Love that threaded the sounds of the letters into his lyrics. And I just rang him up and said, I think this is perfect. Can I steal this, or can I compensate you, or where did you get the idea? And he said, all he said was, there's no such thing as a new idea, Tim. And that was it. And Casey's one of the great humans on the planet. So, you know, I've thanked him in the program and in the songbook and stuff, but I always, whenever I have a chance to tell the story, I do, because it's a great idea and it works perfectly for this song.
Before you go, will you play us out?
Oh, sure.
Well, and in the theater, there are hundreds, maybe 1,000 people doing some audience interaction. We've conscripted a small audience so that listeners can get at least a sense of what happens. And so go ahead.
Yeah, right. So I've got everyone sitting around in the studio to yell out letters just so that the listeners can hear what's going on, because it is a bit weird. So I'll count you in, all right? Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah. Three. And so you think you're able to survive this mess by being a prince or a princess. You will soon see there's no escaping tragedy. And even if you put in heaps of effort, you're just wasting energy, 'cause your life as you know it is ancient history. I have suffered in this jail, have been trapped inside this cage for ages, this living hell. But if I try, I can remember back before my life had ended, before my happy days were over, before I first heard the pealing of the bell. Like you, I was curious, so innocent, I asked 1,000 questions. But unless you want to suffer, listen up and I will teach you a thing or two. You listen here, my dear, you'll be punished so severely if you step out of line, and if you cry it will be double. You should stay out of trouble and remember to be extremely careful.
Why?
Why? Why? Did you hear what he said? Just you wait for fear. Z. Just
test you wait for is A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P, Q, R, S, T, U, V, W, X, Y. Just you wait for is Z.
Tim Minchin, thank you very much.
It's in the bum problem.
Matilda the Musical is now on Broadway, and it was nominated for 12, count them, 12 Tony Awards. And you can see a video of Tim Minchin singing and playing our big grand piano here in Studio 360 at studio360.org.
Fazioli Manlio.
And that's it for this hour of the show. Thank you very much for listening. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisferam,
Alana Harper,
Anne Hepperman,
Eric Malinsky,
Chloe Plant,
Rachel Lewis-Krisky,
Ellen Mayer,
Mark Sheely.
Thanks, as always, to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum. You can keep up with what's going on behind the scenes at Studio 360 by, quote, liking us on Facebook and following us on Twitter, at Studio 360 Show and at KB Anderson. That's Anderson with an E. And don't forget, upload your high school garage band's best track to our Battle of the High School Bands. All the details are at studio360.org/myhighschoolband.
Support for Studio 360 comes from the car company Scion, dedicated to supporting new talent. At the Scion Motivate Conference, 10 young entrepreneurs were awarded a car, capital, and mentoring. One awardee was Notes for Notes, a nonprofit program in Nashville providing music education to kids. Learn more at scion.com. Studio 360 is funded in part by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Vampires and superheroes have made Joss Whedon a king in Hollywood, but families harder to please.
It's an argument I've had with my stepfather over the years. He'd be like, when are you going to make a real grown-up picture without the vampires and those rocket ships? And I was like, never.
Joss Whedon's new movie is Shakespeare. No vampires, no rocket ships. That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.